Welcome to the Teen Life Podcast, where we believe that teenagers are not a problem to be solved. We are here to help you equip teenagers through the power of connection. Hey guys, this is Chris Roby, and across from me is my co-host Carly Duke.
Hello.
Hey guys, so we are continuing our TL Selects through the month of December and early January this year. We're revisiting some of our older episodes of the Teen Life Podcast way back when we did these long-form interviews and talked to really interesting people about really important topics. And this week, we are pulling an interview from 5.5 years ago.
Oh my goodness. 2016.
Yeah, May of 2016, where we were just babes in the podcast universe.
Baby podcasters.
Yeah, baby podcasters. And we recorded this in like a dusty church library somewhere. But we interviewed Sarah Kaler, who is a licensed drug and chemical dependency counselor and works especially with adolescents. And so we felt like in this present time of coming out of pandemic, we are seeing drug and alcohol use skyrocket amongst adolescents. And we feel like this is a really important topic for us to talk through.
Right. And while me and Chris see this just anecdotally and through talking with teenagers, Sarah is an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really wanted to lean in, and we wanted you to hear directly from her on someone who worked in a treatment facility and so saw teenage boys come in with addictions and maybe even some more extreme substance abuse. But she gives some incredible wisdom and insight into what to be looking for, some warning signs for teenagers, and how to have conversations with your teenagers around substance abuse and drugs.
So the facility that Sarah and we mentioned pretty frequently throughout the interview is not one that either one of us work with anymore. And so if you hear us talk about those, the important part is more so getting some insight into what inpatient rehab looks like for an adolescent. Not that your student, if they are struggling with drugs or chemical dependency, necessarily need to go to a facility like this, but understanding that this is an option for some kids who really do need that more intense help, need to kind of get away from situations, cool off a bit, and to get more focused, purposeful treatment. There are great facilities in every city who do things like this. We were really proud of this interview. We want you to enjoy this and let us know what you think. So this is an interview with Sarah Kaler from 2016 on substance abuse and adolescence. Take a listen. Sarah, welcome. Really glad that you're here. Sarah is the program manager of TYRC. It's also called the Youth Campus now. TYRC is the
Tarrant Youth Recovery Campus.
So tell us a little bit about your, I guess, educational background, your licensure, kind of, I guess, the letters behind your name. Why are we talking to you today?
I have my bachelor's and master's both in rehabilitation studies and counseling from UNT. I am a licensed chemical dependency counselor, a certified rehabilitation counselor, and currently a licensed professional counselor intern. Been at MHMR for about 6 years.
MHMR is?
As a organization, as a company. Mm-hmm. I've been at the campus now for 5 years.
Okay.
I have worked residential at the campus. I've worked outpatient, done little odds and end programming positions, and just at this point, I'm the program manager, and I run both programs with the residential and the outpatient side.
Okay.
Great. And for those that don't know what MHMR stands for, what is that actual organization? What do those letters stand for?
At this point in the game, my health, my resource.
Okay. So that's another name change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked a lot about changes now, mm-hmm. how there's name changes, and they reflect current just attitude changes towards mental health services and treatment and recovery. We talked a little bit about that before we even pushed record. Just kind of in the big picture in general, talk about some of the attitude shifts you are seeing when it comes to treatment, recovery with students. And maybe not even necessarily just with students, but in general.
We are definitely becoming more trauma sensitive, mm-hmm. would be the correct way to put that. Trying to take those stigmas that society has placed on mental health disorders and substance use disorders, instead of a negative light, that it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because there's something wrong, whether it's a hidden disability or an actual physical disability, it's okay that somebody has that, and it's what can we do to help overcome these barriers.
Mm-hmm. Well, for students that actually come to TYRC, you said earlier, you have inpatient and outpatient. What's the difference, and what do the students look like depending on which program they go into?
Well, the majority of who we see are juvenile probation kids, whether they walk in the door or we actually also are set up to assess them at juvenile detention on Kimbo Road. It determines at that point what their recommendation is. What, as a clinician, what do they need, you know, for treatment?
Right.
Mm-hmm. They usually, when they walk in the door, depending on however they get their probation or school or just families are noticing a problem, we try to start them out outpatient, the least restrictive level of care, give them an opportunity. If we notice that they're still, you know, continuing to use or they're still having issues, at that point, as a team, we'll discuss residential and the next level of care.
Okay. I guess I'm curious on what kind of substance do y'all usually deal with the most? Is that, and I'm sure that's somewhat of a moving target sometimes, you know, depending on what's going on. For a student that winds up in a treatment program like yours, what's typically the substance that they are abusing the most?
Marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say about 90 to 95% is marijuana.
Okay.
There are other substances that they've either tried or maybe they won't admit to. They could even be addicted to. I've seen a trend with different areas. North Arlington, for instance, and even East Side Arlington, there's a huge heroin problem.
Hmm.
So we've had our Arlington kids have a lot more heroin issues, but for the majority, it is marijuana.
Okay.
That is their main issue. And to me, I feel like on the adolescent side, it's more of a lifestyle versus necessarily just I need this drug to survive and to function. Hmm. So I need the lifestyle that goes with that.
Right.
The money, the fame.
Right.
Interesting.
So talking about this youth, what age do you see them battling addiction?
Well, we accept clients, you know, on the surface level, it's 13 to 17. However, we've had 12-year-olds come in and we've had 18, 19-year-olds mm-hmm. come in, depending on if they're in school. I mean, we can actually accept anyone up to 21 years old if they're still in school. And it's really a range. I see a lot of 15, 16-year-olds, the kind of the average on the age. But it's hard, again, to give them that addiction diagnosis, if you will,
right.
just because it is kind of – for them, sometimes it's such a what they know, mm-hmm. what they've learned, what they just know. That's their normal to them versus maybe an adult where they have moved away from home or they've, you know, experienced and become more mature and make their own kind of decisions and choices. So it's a little different on that aspect. It's hard for even the majority of the clients in there to say, yeah, I'm addicted to weed, because they're not even quite sure what that even fully means just yet.
Right. Have you seen if they come in younger of long-term drug use, or is it easier for them to break those habits or whatever that looks like, that lifestyle that you're talking about? And does age have an effect on that?
You know, I don't think it really does. What I see is that the younger they come in, the longer I'm going to see them there. Mm-hmm. It's almost a revolving door. I think I see more if they come in 13, 14 years old. There's definite more consequence, especially in the legal system and even in their adult. I mean, you know, they turn 18, they get off probation maybe through juvenile, but it's not long that they start getting in trouble on the adult side. So it's no specific age. It's unfortunate. Our success rate isn't that high. It's kind of a one out of every eight kids will be successful. Mm. Age isn't really a determinant factor for that either.
Right.
I'm glad to hear you say the one out of eight stat, because I'll hear ads on the radio for different treatment centers where they talk about 90-95% success rates. And I'm like, and I kind of eye roll a little bit because I'm wondering by what standards are they measuring success?
Right.
Would probably be the big thing. Why is there such a low success rate for full recovery?
Yeah. The concept of addiction, the disease concept, the biopsychosocial. You know, we have the biological side, the psychological side, and the social side. I think that in itself, to me, kind of describes, kind of help defines why the adolescents aren't as successful as possibly the adults. I can see adults being successful. There's a lot more resources for the adults. Mm-hmm. Adolescents, there's not. I mean, there are only two other treatment facilities in this area. And a lot of times our clients will kind of bounce back and forth depending on payer sources and funding information. But it's that after treatment, they still go back to their home environment. They still hang out with the same friends. They still do the people, places, and things that they can't change as maybe an adult can change. And that's the biggest thing when we talk about recovery is those people, places, and things. If you can't avoid them, well, how can you cope with them? How can you deal with them? A lot of times they're at a spot too where they can't even really identify yet their emotions and their feelings. And so, again, when you have those learned behaviors that, or even the, you know, just innate kind of mental behaviors that leads them to, I need something to help me. And this is what I know. Mm-hmm. It's even that much harder.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter where you live or how much, you know, you make, or drugs are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's just learning how to cope with that and mm-hmm. deal with those.
Right. Right. So it sounds like the younger that, I mean, you'd said this, but just the more that I'm kind of getting the picture here of a middle schooler dealing with this, it's, I wouldn't say it's hopeless, but man, that's,
it's hard.
It's a really difficult, because, you know, because what is in a student's power to change their environment at that age? I mean, what can right. they do?
Right.
I mean, do you feel like there is anything that, I mean, as you guys talk through and they're, you know, they're going back to their home, what are some strategies that you share with a student to say, you know, to change their environment? You know, if their dad's smoking or there's some kind, you know, something in the home that's really dysfunctional, what can a kid do?
It reminds me of the specific client. This client I had a few years back, he really wanted to stay clean, really wanted to stay clean. Had a very difficult time, continued to relapse. And I remember having this discussion, this exact discussion with him and his home environment. And he was able to really identify and process with me, him and his mom's relationship. And kind of her, you know, in his terms, she's irrational and very hard. And before treatment, it was, she was the reason I used. She was the reason I continued, you know, to get in trouble. When he was in treatment, it was the, you can't change your mom, but you can change you. Mm-hmm. And really focusing on changing your behaviors, your reactions. And that's kind of what that question led me to, is thinking about that situation. But overall, we really try to incorporate just the family portion of it and really try to just build up that communication and that trust again mm-hmm. to where the parents can help the clients and, the you know, mm-hmm. overall to help them. Mm-hmm.
I want to dive a little more into that, because what can parents do to minimize the risk for their children? So even maybe before you get into that or before they start using drugs, what can the family do? What can the parents do to minimize that risk?
I don't think there's a lot that any parent can do to really prevent drug use from happening. Peer pressure is hard, especially middle school, especially high school. You want to fit in. You want to be cool. You want to smoke weed. You want to drink alcohol. I think that and I hate to make it sound okay, but at some level, it's an acceptance of the parents. Mm-hmm. My kid might experiment with drugs and alcohol. Okay, so what do I need to do to help so it doesn't lead into further and greater things? Let's talk about it. Let's process it. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, you're a horrible child or that you're no good or, you know, all the things that you're doing wrong. But let's talk about some of the consequences. And I've really, especially with adolescents, it's been more of, tell me what you think might happen if you continue. You know, tell me about your friends and what you've seen, and trying to just really open up that line of communication. That's been the biggest thing, that if a kid comes to a parent's, you know, I've used, or yeah, you know, I kind of like it and I don't know what to do, or, you know, and the parent's not like, I can't believe you, here you go again, you know, mm-hmm. versus right. tell me about it. What's going on? What's leading you to that mm-hmm. that point?
Yeah.
Yeah. So being able to keep that communication open, to have a discussion and
absolutely
to get help as well. Now, after they've started treatment or they realize that they are using drugs or addicted to drugs, what can the family do then to help them in that treatment process?
Again, it's that communication piece.
Okay.
I really feel that it's, you know, relapse is a part of recovery. Some parents have the, that's unacceptable. Well, but it is what it is, and it's what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And it's helped, helping the parent see that not only can you be supportive to the client, but also get help for yourself as well. You know, seek those Al-Anon meetings, or, you know, those supportive kind of outside group meetings to help with their support as well, to help support their, you know,
right,
their child. And a lot of times I do see a family trend, you know, with drug use, especially with adolescents. I mean, I'm seeing kids starting smoking weed at 9 years old, 8 years old. I heard 6 at one point. I'm like, somebody had to give that to that child, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
Even at 9, 12, 13. Yeah. Let me try that.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, and usually that's within the home environment. Maybe it's even cousins or stepbrothers or, you know, older family members. And it's such a family situation, is such a family dynamic that's affected. Mm-hmm. It's just really trying to bring that back together, and even calling out the parents and saying, hey, you know, do you want this cycle to continue? Do you realize your kid's a sponge?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this what you want to see for them as well?
Right. So you talked about the consequences a little bit, and obviously there's the legal side of dealing with, you know, substance abuse, but talk a little bit about the developmental side, about, you know, and we can really talk more around marijuana, since that seems to be the big thing. And I've gotten roped into many debates with middle school kids about the merits of smoking pot.
Yes.
And I don't do that anymore, because I don't.
You don't do pot anymore? Or you
that,
don't
that, that and, and get into these debates, because it's an incredible waste of time.
It is.
But, you know, there's a lot of research out there. We're going to link some of the research you sent me.
Sure.
That's specific to our area. But for a student who is actively using marijuana at, you know, in that meaty developmental age of, you know, 14 to 18, or even, you know, down to 12 or 13, what are they risking?
It's a definite interference of development in any drug, whether it be marijuana, alcohol. They always say in recovery, and really in addiction in general, that you are the age you started. It's like your brain stops at that point. And then once you become clean, it does catch up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes about 6 to 18 months for your brain to really kind of heal after discontinue use. Just, again, the chemicals in your brain and the rewiring and such. The marijuana debate's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It is very hard. I definitely have had that debate as well with several kids. It's, well, you know, it's God put it here, and it's legalized and here, and it's what have you. I tend to educate them more about marijuana itself. Well, I mean, it's legal in Colorado, so why can't I, you know, smoke it here? Or, well, regardless, even if it was legal here, there would still be an age limit. It would still be mm-hmm. illegal for you. That's kind of how I counteract those arguments, because it's at this point, and especially with the probation side, you're on probation.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to smoke weed, do it until, you know, after you are done reporting your life to somebody else that pretty much determines your fate.
Mm-hmm.
The main risk that they ever really say is the possible health effects with the lungs and the smoking, and it's still the chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there hasn't been anything just clear as day after all of this time with marijuana that says, this is what it does to you,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
or maybe cocaine does this or heroin does that. There's not much with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a hard debate, especially with those middle school kids, mm-hmm. but I see more physical consequences from the things, the inhalants, the mm-hmm. the triple C's, which is the it's an over-the-counter cough, cold, and congestion.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally have to take enough to overdose to get that high.
Mm-hmm.
And kids will do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the K2, because they don't want to get caught smoking marijuana. The
synthetic stuff, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That stuff's really dangerous.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I see more negative effects, like physically present, with those versus the marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
But earlier you kind of talked about a lifestyle that comes mm-hmm. around with marijuana. And are there negative connotations or effects that come with that?
And that's exactly where it comes more from. It's more getting that and acquiring that. Maybe it's selling. Maybe it's the committing illegal activities and engaging in those illegal activities to get that drug. You know, and that's, I think, to kind of wrap around back to the family side too, when how can the family help? Well, if you see that the kid's not going to school, if you see that the kids starting to get in trouble, like you see the interference, staying out all night, running away, coming up with things that they shouldn't come up with, like, you know, a new gaming system or mm-hmm. clothes, and you're like, I didn't buy that.
Right.
Those are those warning signs too that the parents can see, and hey, tell me how you got that. That's that lifestyle, that easy money and hustling and, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of the gang life that I see a lot in Fort Worth.
I appreciate your honest answer on that, because that's not the first person I've heard that from, that there's just a lot of question marks.
There is. There.
And I don't think that's, I think people who are strongly on one side or the other will use that as an opportunity to say, see, and I don't think that's what that means at all. I think that means that's, we don't know. And I think that you might know better than I do. I know that the hard research is pretty young on this. It hasn't been around very long, and not enough time has passed to really know what these things do to us physically.
No, I mean, it was, what was it, the 20s, 30s when reefer came out?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little later, 40s. I don't remember. Don't quote me in the year.
I wasn't around, so.
Yeah. Me neither. But that was we don't know what it does. So we think it creates psychosis. So we're going to make it legal. And there's that, or illegal rather. And then there's that hemp side of it and the economy with the hemp portion of it. I think they're realizing that the only difference that I have seen in the last, not personally seen, but that I've researched and read, last 50 to 60 years, the only thing that's changed has been the increase of the actual THC level. It's more potent mm-hmm. than it used to be.
Right.
And they have done other, the dabs, which is the liquid, or I'm sorry, the wax of the THC. It's very concentrated. So where, okay, marijuana, when my parents smoked it in the 60s and 70s, was it maybe a 3-4% THC level? The marijuana they're getting on the streets now is anywhere between a 9-15% THC level. Wow. And those dabs are at about a 70-80% concentrated THC level. Hmm. And even still, again, it's that there's no physical, overdoses. There's no, it maybe can create, anxiety or panic or irregular heartbeat, but nothing, like a heroin overdose, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's just become more intense.
So going back to kind of talking to people who are helping teenagers, whether that's a teacher or a parent or a youth minister, what's one of the first helpful things they can do if they start seeing, like you said, some warning signs of if they're skipping school or if they're getting in trouble, but when they finally confront that student or that teenager and realize that they're using drugs, what are some of the first steps that they can take to help that teenager?
Engaging with them, talking with them. Hey, I see you've been missing a lot of school. You tell me about that. What's been going on? You seem a lot more tired today, or I see some changes in you. Let's talk about those.
At what point would you recommend them seek other treatment, whether that's counseling or whether that's coming to a place like TYRC? At what point do they need to say, okay, we need help outside of our family, outside of what we can do for them?
I think it's a hard thing to gauge. It really depends on the family, because it depends on if the family's like, nope, there's going to be no marijuana use. They are going directly to treatment. And they come to me and I'm like, you've smoked once. I mean, I can definitely do some intervention. We can work a small program. We have that flexibility. And then there's some families that it's like, oh, it's fine. It's just weed. I mean, I smoke weed. And I know there's consequences, but it's fine. And they don't ever come. Mm-hmm. So, or the probation is.
That's all right.
Is forcing them to come.
She's getting animated over here.
I know. Yeah. Starting to wake up here. So it's, and even if there's that negative reinforcement, it's still, oh, why? It's just marijuana. So sometimes I get more the question of, is it ever the wrong time? You know, or what qualifies? Well, I mean, again, I mean, if you smoked a couple of times, we can do some intervention. We can do some basic, just kind of social skills, communication skills, looking at your support system, classic intervention stuff, or prevention stuff. Or if it gets to that point that we do need to intervene, then, you know, but anybody that walks through that door or calls to make an appointment, we're going to see, we're going to determine, you know, where they're at in their life and what they've kind of given up for their use.
So is it as simple as that? And I'm thinking about access to services.
Yes.
Give you a holler and.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only with all my referral sources, all my contacts, anybody just in general, there is a 211 line for help and resource that's 24/7. We have a crisis care line as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things that unfortunately, I don't know if the public really fully knows. But it's kind of, especially the 211, it's a all kind of all stop, all place stop for anything and everything that one might need.
Mm-hmm. We're about to wrap up here. Just a couple of quick kind of last questions. One of them is about schools.
Okay.
And what role does a school play with the student? And I'm going to probably meander around till I get to where I want to go on this question. But
buckle up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be a wild ride. Well, I guess if a student is... If they find their primary support at school, you know, they feel like those are the places they can ask for help the most. Where would a student access services that would at least point them in the right direction at a school? And then I guess also, how do schools deal with this stuff? Or do they deal with it well? Or is it, and not to get you in trouble, but just to kind of see what you think about that. Yeah.
Well, I did just have a small little in-service with Family Resource Center. For Fort Worth ISD, just actually last week, there's been a change with the truancy court laws as of September 2015. Prior to that date, and this is what we were seeing, is that the judge for the municipal court for truancy was awesome with treatment and ordering those kids into getting those services, whether it was just, I've smoked a couple times, or yeah, that's why I was starting to skip school, versus I'm good, I have some issues, I don't have transportation, you know, this is why I'm missing school. That was a great resource to have with truancy, because I feel like with the schools, kind of around the bush here, with the schools, we can almost, truancy is like the first sign. I mean, when you start seeing that kids not excelling in school and skipping school, there's something going on. Mm-hmm. And a lot more than often, it is some sort of substance use or just negative peer pressure, what have you. With those laws changing, I've seen a decrease with that. I mean, I know that I could go into probably any school across the Metroplex and have, I mean, an endless amount of clients on all levels. And so they're trying to really kind of prevent, because, you know, the truancy, again, the laws have changed to where it's been more on the family side and the parent side versus the kid being held accountable for that. And no longer is it a punishable offense. So it becomes difficult with that, and trying to help the interventionists at the school and help facilitate with them. What can I, you know, and that was what I talked with the Family Resource Center last week. What can I do to help encourage these families to seek help and seek treatment? You know, a lot of the times there's so many kids and the schools are so saturated with students and teachers and administrators.
Yeah.
They don't catch it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just trying to stop it before it, you know, progresses. Because that's, like, again, it's like truancy and then probation and then even more consequence. I guess that kind of maybe answer your question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Because it all plays in together. I think that the truancy thing is really interesting, how the laws have changed on that. And I think it's good for the listener to be able to hear, you know, that's a great indicator to know something is up at school. You know, they're missing school and people are noticing that, you know, the truancy courts are getting involved. That's a pretty good indicator something's going on. So,
right. And to know when to ask good questions too. I think that's what I hear you saying, of there might not be any sure sign indicator of your student or your child is abusing substance, but you can ask good questions, and here are ways that you can ask good questions. So kind of to wrap up, we want to ask you two different questions, and I'll ask you the first one so I don't overwhelm you all at once. But what is the most important thing that you want the listener to hear from you today?
With adolescents, even though there is a lack of resource in this region, in this area, it's very important to just continue with if there's a problem, let's try to get a hold of it. Let's try to help these adolescents to help them succeed. I mean, they are our future.
Mm-hmm.
And it saddens me with the different law changes, whether it be truancy or even through juvenile probation. I don't feel like that they are failing them necessarily. I feel like us as a community are failing these adolescents because of the lack of resource, because of the lack of mentor programs, the lack of things that aren't available as they would be for the adults. For me, that's been the biggest kind of, I want people to be aware that this starts very early on. And if we don't stop it now, it'll continue.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to stop it? How can we help? How can we assist?
Right.
And then the last big question we have for you today is, what's a good question that you can ask a student who's going through addiction or who is using drugs or alcohol or any sort of substance like that?
What's going on? And simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I see this and this and this. I mean, you good? What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me. You know, let me help you. What's going on?
Mm-hmm. What's going on? I like that a lot. So just something simple where it's going to open up some conversation. Yeah. Well, Sarah, this has been great. Like, I'm there each week and I don't get to hear all this stuff. So this has been great for me to hear, and really appreciate your time on that.
Awesome.
So,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right. That's a wrap on this one. Thank you so much for listening. A special thanks to Carly Duke and to Kelly Fan for producing this podcast. Also to Luke Cabrera for our awesome podcast music. If you want to know more about Luke and his music, check out his contact info in the description. Well, this podcast is for the helpers, and we really hope you feel helped. If there's something we haven't talked about or a topic that you're really interested in, email us at podcast@teenlife.ngo, and we will do our best to get to that topic. We will see you next week.